if you're a patient that has gone to see physicians and you're like, I know I'm eating as healthy as I can, right? I've been putting in that effort. I know I'm exercising. Why do I still feel this way? That's part of the lifestyle medicine. People are really shocked when they get that sleep or they put up the boundaries at work. Oh, I feel better. And it didn't involve taking yet another medicine. It's a really powerful message because it's a message essentially of empowerment.
Today is Tuesday and it's time for a brand new episode of the Reclaim Your Rise podcast. I'm your host, Lauren Bongiorno. I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 7 years old, and now I'm the founder and CEO of Risley Health. We are nationally board certified health coaches who understand that diabetes is more than a math problem to be solved. It's an experience to be managed. So we built a health coaching model that's helped thousands of people reclaim the life they deserve. If you're ready to stop struggling alone and finally experience freedom and confidence with T1D, this podcast is the right place to start. Before we start the show, remember that this podcast shouldn't be a substitute for personalized professional medical advice. Always talk with your physician or medical professional before changing your diet, insulin dosages, or healthcare plan. All right, let's reclaim your eyes. For the first time this year, we ran a few of them last year, but we did not do them a lot this year yet. We are going to be having on May 19th a brand new free A1C masterclass. It is going to be a virtual webinar that I'll be hosting if you need to lower your A1C this year in 2024. If you want to, whether you have goals to become pregnant, or maybe you're kind of sitting in that like 7.5 A1C range where you're like, no one's ever told me that this is bad, but I know I can be doing a lot better than this. And when you have a little bit better control, you have more focus, you have more clarity, you have more peace of mind, you have more energy, you just feel like you're living more in a body that is only impacted by diabetes here and there versus being on this roller coaster of like constantly being impacted by diabetes. No matter where you are on this A1C journey, if you do have a goal to lower your A1C and you've been struggling with the how, come to this masterclass. I will put the link in the show notes below. Reserve your seat. We are going to cap it at 500 people. I'll be answering questions at the end. It is free. So take advantage of that. We're going to be doing about 75 minutes of that entire masterclass, and you're going to walk away with a lot of tools and strategies and notes to implement. So I hope to see you there. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Reclaim Your Rise. So today I have a repeat guest on. Returning to the podcast is Dr. Sandra Sobel, who is here to talk to us about the link between type 1 diabetes and thyroid disease. Dr. Sobel is the CEO of Summon Health, which is a direct endocrine clinic in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that's focused on personalized medical delivery of medical health conditions. What is so great is that Dr. Sobel has a board certification in lifestyle medicine in addition to endocrinology. So she really takes a whole person approach when working with patients and has experience with patients both in type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes. I personally do not have any challenges with my thyroid. However, wanted to do this episode and give like a full focus to it because studies have reported that the risk of thyroid dysfunction in people with type 1 diabetes is 2 to 3 times higher than in the general population. So if you have thyroid disease that runs in your family and you have type 1, or you were recently told that you have issues with your thyroid, or if you've been living with it for a while, this episode is a must listen to. Truly, I initially set out to record this and I was like, okay, we'll ask Dr. Sobel some questions. We'll get like a 30-minute episode in. The episode ended up going way longer and I think we had to end up cutting it because there was just so much good information in here, like down to Dr. Sobel sharing like what specific supplement can actually, that if you're taking it, it alters your blood work. And so make sure you're not taking it before you get your blood work and your thyroid. Like there's just so much here that you're not just going to get from an article of like that you type into Google on type 1 diabetes and thyroid. So I'm going to stop talking because we have so much to get into. And without further ado, help me give a warm welcome to Dr. Sandra and let's rise. Dr. Sobel, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me back, Lauren.
You were on the, I think it was episode, I have it here. It was episode 24, I believe. Episode 24. So the first year that the podcast was out and—
Are you on episode like 2,452 now, I feel?
Exactly. That's exactly. No, not that. We air one episode a week on Tuesdays, and then sometimes we'll throw in like a bonus episode on Thursdays, sometimes for parents and caregivers. So we're not up there yet quite, but we're getting up there.
Oh my gosh. Well, no, yes. So the last time we were talking about, I mean, your episodes are so informative, and I know you hear this from everybody, but I'm sure for the people who consume who have type 1 diabetes or for care for people who have type 1 diabetes, but I'll tell you, it's a wonderful resource also for healthcare providers to also hear from the perspective of individuals living with type 1 diabetes or just the questions that people have. So it's a wonderful thing that you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That means a lot coming from you. I have the utmost respect, which is why I wanted to have you back on the show. And last time we spoke more about kind of just like overcoming limitations in healthcare, your background and really how you focus on lifestyle medicine and looking at the whole body approach. And not every endocrinologist may have that extra training or looking at it at the same way that you do. And I feel like we're very aligned. And I think a lot of people in our community wish every endocrinologist was more like you and how you looked at things. So we're going to talk about thyroid health specifically today. But before we dive in, I thought we can do like a little bit of an update. I haven't shared that you were specifically the one that I went to first when I thought my dad had type 1 diabetes. And I was like, I'm going crazy. I need a second, like, kind of look at this approach. And you were like, send me the labs, like, let me take a look. So when was that, back in like August of last year?
I feel like you're right, around then. And it's always one of those things, right? Where I'd be really curious to hear what your reaction was when you saw it, what your dad's reaction was. You know, as somebody from the outside and seeing the labs, I'm like, your suspicion was right, Lauren. This is type 1 diabetes. You know, it presents very differently when we're diagnosing this in adults versus in children, because it's just the onset of disease is so different. And so it takes time to just wrap your head around that, right? And process that, especially if you're the adult getting diagnosed later in life. I'm like, are you sure? So, like, how is he doing? How did he take it? I'd love to hear updates.
I know. Everybody always asks, like, when I post my dad, just, you know, it could be like him, we're going on a walk or something when I'm with him or whatever. And everyone's like, oh my God, update. And I'm like, really, I think the challenge is that there hasn't been much of an update because the metformin so far is keeping his A1C kind of at bay. It's around like a 6.5 with just metformin, but like he's extreme in terms of, and he shared, this is nothing that he wouldn't share because we did a podcast episode with him in November about it, but he is just really tight on nutrition and exercise. And I think if that was not the case, his numbers would not be what they are, and he would have to be on insulin definitely by now. But I do think it's kind of just helping it right now. And, you know, we're just taking it kind of like every 3 months by 3 months and checking in.
Well, he has an amazing resource that he can always tap into, right, with you, and has learned, I'm sure, a lot through your journey. And you guys, as with anyone with type 1 diabetes, everyone's journey is individual to them, but it's so helpful to be able to pull from others' experiences and tap into those resources when necessary to try to like understand your own disease. So I'm so happy to hear. Please tell him I say hi.
I will. You were a savior though. Like, I think when you're so close to it, you, not like that you deny, but you're just like, I need somebody who's not emotional to just look at this and be able to objectively state what's going on here. And I, you know, having you as that person also inspired us to talk more about that type 1.5 and LADA, and that there are so many people who I think kind of point fingers in the wrong direction. Like, a lot of people get frustrated that, okay, I was diagnosed as type 2 for years and was never given the correct diagnosis. Like, how did my doctor miss this? And I think what I've learned throughout this process and talking to a lot of people and a lot of our clients at Risley, and I'm sure you have had people like this as well within your clinic and your practice, what I've realized is that it really is challenging because it presents as type 2 for a really long time. And so it's almost like unless you gave a C-peptide or antibody test to like everyone, it's really tough to see. And at the same time, I think a lot of doctors, which I can kind of see, have the approach, even if it is and does turn into type 1, will address that when it gets to that point. But like we're addressing it as it is right now. We're just dealing with mitigating the blood sugars. I think the only differentiating, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts about this, but where I think different is that there are things that you can do now, like T's yield, where if you do know ahead of time that you have a risk and you're going to develop type one, you can be on something to really kind of push it out and prolong when the diagnosis.
Absolutely. Yes. And this all highlights just the rapid development of therapies in type 1 diabetes as far as disease modifying therapy. So that's what T's yield is. You know, if we can catch it in an earlier stage, we can prolong the complete conversion to dysglycemia by intervening sooner. Or even in the diagnosis of stage 3, there are now medicines that have been studied like verapamil. Can we preserve beta cell function and some C-peptide secretion for longer? And there's data that shows that, yeah, that can be the case. So there's so much going on and we have so many more tools available in our armamentarium to try to modify the disease process. So yeah. But to your point, as far as the diagnosis continues to be a challenge, and one of the things that has also become clear in type 1 diabetes research is trying to get more people screened and, you know, make it accessible, right? And I think the big onus on the medical profession is we need to know which antibodies need to be screened and have this conversation much earlier on and have a lower threshold to screen individuals for type 1 diabetes. And especially people who have histories of autoimmunity, and this will segue into our discussion, but I'll just add as an aside, as I'm talking about screening, there are screens that are available for type 1 diabetes that are free. And I'll just tell you, I actually have ordered screening kits for my kids. I have 2 kids. I will be doing, it's a capillary, it's a finger stick, and I'll be doing that this week. It's screening for all the antibodies because there is autoimmunity in my family. I myself have Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, and I take a medicine for that. So, you know, just my brother has celiac disease. And so there is that in the family. And anytime someone has one autoimmune condition, they are at higher risk of other autoimmune conditions. And I feel as part of my responsibility as an endocrinologist to know what my family's risk is and my kids. So I've made the decision with my husband, we made the decision to screen our kids and to know what their risk of type 1 diabetes is. And in this risk kit, it also screens for antibodies for celiac disease. And that's through the University of Colorado. So I'm happy to talk to you later about it or provide links for people if they're interested in learning more about it. But yeah, because of the history of autoimmunity in the family, that's why we're doing this. And I know we're going to be talking about autoimmunity in general and risks associated with that. So just thought I'd throw that in there.
Absolutely. No, thank you for sharing. I think that everybody has their own personal preferences and whether they want to get their kids tested or not. And I can see the pros and cons for both sides, but that's so great to know that there's a resource available for like that is easily accessible that people can do at their home. So with that, let's talk about thyroid because you live with thyroid disorder disease. Like how do you even recognize the condition? Is that the correct?
Yeah. All of the above. The multiple choice, all of the above.
What do you want to call it? Whatever is up to you. So you are dealing with hypothyroidism, and I would love to, can we start with just generally what is the difference between hypothyroidism and hyperthyroidism for everybody who doesn't know or needs some clarification?
Absolutely. So I'll talk about it as thyroid disease. And so with thyroid disease, hypothyroidism specifically refers to when the thyroid gland is unable to make enough thyroid hormone. That's hypothyroidism. The opposite, hyperthyroidism, is when the thyroid gland makes too much thyroid hormone. And so there are different causes to both of those, but just the overall definitions, hypo, not enough thyroid hormone is being made from the thyroid gland. Hyper, too much thyroid hormone is being made by the thyroid gland.
Okay. And so I was doing research before this and found some cross-sectional studies that reported that hypothyroidism is in about 12 to 24% of female and 6% of male patients with type 1 diabetes. And hyperthyroidism occurs in only like 1 to 2 patients with diabetes. So is that something that you feel kind of matches up and you see a lot more of the hypo?
Absolutely. That is absolutely correct. Like anecdotally in clinic, absolutely. And the data that you found is right. Like as far as the statistics, much more hypothyroidism is seen in individuals with type 1 diabetes than hyperthyroidism. Correct.
Okay. And then stats wise, I don't know if you know or just generally can share, but like what does it look like for if you have either a parent, a family member that has autoimmunity? I guess like is there, what is the chance that your child or yeah, I guess like a child has another autoimmune disorder. I imagine it's higher that they would have the same thing that the parent or the grandparent may have, but is there anything that you can share on that in terms of prevalence?
Yeah, absolutely. So especially when it comes to specifically thyroid disease and the exact statistic, the percentage, I don't know off the top of my head, but certainly when I see patients in my clinic who have autoimmune hypothyroidism, I will ask them, is there any family history of thyroid disease or autoimmunity? And I will tell you about 60 to 70% of the time, the answer is yes. You know, my sister has thyroid disease, my grandmother had thyroid disease, whatnot. And if it's not thyroid disease, then some other type of autoimmunity. And I think here it's important that medical providers are specific about what autoimmunity is, because sometimes that can be confusing. We can't just assume that when we ask the question, does anyone else have a history of autoimmunity in your family? People know automatically what that means. So I'll list some examples, and that's when I'll say thyroid disease, lupus, celiac disease, Crohn's disease. And so with that, then people are like, oh, actually, I do remember that grandma had, you know, joints that were, you know, really, you know, disfigured, and that was rheumatoid arthritis, right? So autoimmunity in the family certainly is something that's seen that tends to be transmitted.
Okay. And so in terms of the earliest signs, like if somebody knows that their mom has issues with their thyroid, this was actually a question. I have a list of questions below, but that people submitted, but I'm going to jump to this one. If you know that you don't have currently anything wrong with your thyroid, like, but there's a chance like your mom has it, for instance, are there early signs that you would say, hey, like look out for these things, just general symptoms for just keeping an eye out on it?
Great question. And so I'll tell you what some general signs and symptoms are of hypothyroidism and things that would just make you say, ha, I think this is important for me to discuss with my medical provider when I go in for my visits. So certainly if we're speaking specifically women or individuals who menstruate, anytime there is a change in regularity of menstrual cycle, that's something that is abnormal and is worth discussing with your medical professional. Also, any changes in hair. So, you know, if there's been significant hair loss and it is natural for there to be hair loss, right? Anytime the hair goes through a hair follicle cycle, so we're going to have hair growth and hair loss. But this is in excess of what is usual, right? And then anytime there's a change in that's something that's worth discussing. And then we talk about changes in bowel habits. So specifically in hypothyroidism, if you notice that there is increased constipation, that's something that's worth discussing with your medical provider. Additionally, if there's any change in skin, so like overly dry, that's not driven by the season. So it's natural for the skin to get more dry in the winter. But if this is something that persists or is now happening even in summer or a warmer weather, that's something that's important to discuss. Energy levels, where it's, again, you can't tie it to abnormal sleep patterns. You can't tie it to overly being stressed. You can't tie it to poor nutrition. And so the reason why I'm saying that too is because I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this, and I'll tell you, my experience in medical school was, these are the symptoms of hypothyroidism: hair loss, fatigue, constipation, feeling slightly depressed. And I'm like, are they just reading my mind right now? Like, they are describing me, right? And it's true that all of these symptoms can be seen in hypothyroidism. I also remind people, hypothyroidism does not have a monopoly on those symptoms, right? And so if those things are happening, yes, one of the things to be considered is definitely thyroid disease. And there are also other medical conditions that could also contribute to those symptoms too. But if you have a family history of thyroid disease and those symptoms start to present, and there's nothing like direct correlation, like, yeah, you know, I've had this big project coming up, I haven't been sleeping well, I've been overly stressed, it's really important to make sure you don't push it aside and have it properly evaluated.
It's so funny. Like, as you were saying through going through the list, I was having that same exact experience where I'm like, that I think is so frustrating because there are so many things that can overlap. And I just think of blood sugars as one that can be energy draining, right? Or can contribute to weight fluctuations, right? Can contribute to risk of depression. So I remember last year I went to the hematologist because I was convinced. I was like, there is something wrong. I am exhausted all of the time. Like, I feel like my iron levels have to be low. And like, I need you to like, just tell me that that's what it is, because I just need an answer. And I remember he sat me down, the doctor, and he was like, okay, he's like, your iron levels are fine. Like, they're within range. He's like, and I'm like, I'm telling you though, I ruled out, it's not thyroid, it's not this. And he's like, I have a question. I have one question for you. And I was like, okay, what's the question? He's like, do you feel this tired when you're on vacation? And I'm like, well, what do you mean? And he's like, when you go on vacation, like, think about the last vacation, like, do you have this 3 p.m. slump that you constantly are having? And I was like, well, no. And he was like, okay. So when you're sitting behind a computer all day long staring at a screen, like, you need to go outside and like see the sun and just do that and like see how it helps, or like get sunshine first thing in the morning instead of, once again, like being on the screens. And when I do that, my energy levels are so different throughout the day, and it's like a small tweak like that. So I think ruling out things is really helpful, and also recognizing that some of those symptoms around like weight or energy level, like fatigue, like that can be so general that it is possible that not something so big is wrong, and it could just be our lifestyles and that can be contributing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that vacation question is especially one I find to be extremely helpful. And I think it's helpful for the individual too, to have that time to reflect and be like, oh, wait a second. I do feel so much better when I'm on vacation. And if anything, you know, it helps reinforce just the importance of making time to get away and be able to restore, you know, our energy levels and how we feel. And also recognize, like, okay, we do have a certain amount of power over how we feel. And at the same time, you know, it's important too, because I've also seen that the pendulum swing the other way, that people are like, I've been feeling bad for so long. I thought it was just work. I thought it was just stress. And then we get their thyroid levels drawn, and the thyroid levels are just off the charts, right? And so we can see extremes on either side, where someone's feeling so symptomatic, the thyroid levels are completely normal. And therefore, you know, we're very confident it's not the thyroid driving these symptoms. And there clearly is something else that's making somebody feel that way, whether it's lifestyle or other medical condition. And the other side of the pendulum is, people are so symptomatic, they justify it, must be my lifestyle, must be my lifestyle, must be my lifestyle. And yet, it is still important to have those discussions with the medical professionals so that they can do appropriate testing in the event that it is something medical that needs to be addressed and treated.
Right. Yeah. So well said. I guess the reverse, it depends on your personality and how you're analyzing it and going to justify it. So with that being said, is there a way to prolong a thyroid diagnosis, or I guess, what are the things that increase your chances of receiving a thyroid diagnosis? Is there something, or is it inevitable?
Great question. And so one of the many frustrating things in medicine is when the answer is, we don't know yet. So what I will tell you is, here in the United States, the most common cause of hypothyroidism is autoimmune thyroid disease. And autoimmune thyroid disease is Hashimoto's. That's the name that's given to it, Hashimoto's hypothyroidism. Interestingly, people can have Hashimoto's disease, meaning positive thyroid antibodies, but still have normal function of their thyroid. And so we can draw blood tests and we see that the antibodies that correlate with Hashimoto's are elevated. When we look at the thyroid levels, we see that those are still in the normal range. And so the medical term that we give to that is called euthyroid. Euthyroid means normal function of the thyroid, euthyroid Hashimoto's. If the thyroid levels show dysfunction, that thyroid's not making enough hormone, then it's called Hashimoto's hypothyroidism because it's already transitioned into that underfunction stage. And for people who are familiar with the different stages of type 1 diabetes, it's akin to having stage 1 or stage 2 diabetes where you have the positive antibodies, but you don't have the abnormal, in stage 1, you don't have abnormal glucose yet. Right? And so if someone has positive antibodies in type 1 diabetes, but doesn't have abnormal glucose, we don't start them on insulin at that time. Same with the thyroid. If someone has positive antibodies, but normal function of the thyroid, we don't start them on thyroid hormone. And there's a reason for that. So we've actually done human studies, and we have seen that individuals with euthyroid, so normal function of the thyroid, Hashimoto's, and they separated them into two groups. And I'll also mention these were individuals who were symptomatic, you know, those classic symptoms of hypothyroidism, fatigue, weight gain, some mild depression. And they took these individuals who had Hashimoto's but normal function of the thyroid and separated them in two groups. And one group was put on thyroid hormone, the treatment for hypothyroidism, and the other group was put on placebo. Okay, and these pills looked exactly the same, and they followed them over time. And at the end of the study, they did a symptom score and asked, you know, are the symptoms better? And people answered it. And when they looked at the difference between the groups, there was zero difference between the groups in symptom score. So those individuals who had been taking placebo versus those who had been given the thyroid hormone had no difference in their symptoms. However, those who had been put on thyroid hormone had increased risk of abnormal heart rhythm, as well as increased risk of bone turnover, so weakening of the bones. And because of that, that's why we don't recommend treatment of euthyroid Hashimoto's for the general public. If someone knows that they have positive antibodies and they're thyroid is functioning normal in general, and I'll give you some caveats, but in general, we say we're going to monitor your thyroid function, okay? And you should get your thyroid levels drawn at least once a year to monitor that function. And what I tell patients too, I'm like, if at any point within that year you notice significant changes in your symptoms, then let me know, come back in and let's recheck your thyroid to see if it's converted at that time into hypothyroidism, right? You don't have to wait exactly 1 year for us to redraw your levels. So in general, that's the recommendation. And then to get to that, this is my very long-winded response to your answer, Lauren. You know, is there something I can do to prevent the conversion to hypothyroidism? And that's when I say, like, we don't know yet, but in general, you know, we say, if we can lead a lifestyle that is as healthy as possible to reduce any type of triggers, whether environmental, you know, or within our bodies that might augment this autoimmune attack of the thyroid, that's what we try to promote. And so what does that mean? I tell my patients, make sure you're aiming to get enough sleep every night, right? So 7 to 9 hours of restful sleep per night. Try to mitigate stress as much as possible. Don't smoke, right? All these carcinogens and inflammatory chemicals that get introduced into the body through cigarette smoke might augment that autoimmune attack. Be really mindful of alcohol intake, avoid excessive alcohol intake, and really try to follow a nutrition pattern that is as healthy as possible, high in fiber, high in lean protein, low in unhealthy fats. And with that type of a lifestyle, that's as much as a person can do to try to help prevent any accelerated transition to hypothyroidism. Unlike type 1 diabetes, where if someone has two or more positive antibodies, it's 100% guaranteed that they'll develop type 1 diabetes over their lifetime. In Hashimoto's, it is not 100% guaranteed that they will develop hypothyroidism. And so again, we don't know who's going to develop it and who's not. And hopefully one of these days we will be able to, but until then, we just, the recommendation is to try to follow as healthy as a lifestyle as possible to help prevent the accelerated transition to hypothyroidism.
Hey there, it's Neil Greathouse. I am one of the coaches here at Rizely. And this past week, I heard a story from one of our coaching clients. Her name is Allison. And I just thought you'd like to hear it. So Allison had this fear of insulin. Maybe you can relate to that. And that fear of insulin led to high blood sugars and all that shame that goes along with it. And she came into Rizely and she got connected with Jihan. She's one of our coaches. She's fantastic. And Jihan said that they work together to not panic, you know, when it comes to low blood sugars. And then obviously that high spike afterwards, right? Who's with me on the high spike after? Now, Allison has been living with T1D for 46 years and has really just been doing the bare minimum for almost a year, just trying to avoid it. So Coach Jihan bragged about Allison and said that she came to every single call like ready to coach herself and talk through the blocks that are holding her back. And she was ready to move through them. And Allison said that she started to feel like she was actually living again, not just surviving. Jihan said this word for word, "Allison is one of the most courageous clients I've ever had. She's doing things even though she's scared, and she's making moves on her commitments each session." These kind of stories are why Rizely is here. Like, as coaches who live with type 1 diabetes, it is a privilege to find the root of what's holding you back and celebrate with people like Allison. So if you want to talk to somebody on our team or apply for coaching, you can check out RizelyHealth.com so you can stop struggling alone and finally experience freedom and confidence with T1D.
Well, thank you for running us through all of that. I think it was necessary. And the first thing that I was thinking of as you were speaking about that was that I feel like it's very hard for people to get on board with preventative care. It's hard to say if you can do this, this can increase the likelihood that, or decrease the likelihood that it does turn into, you know, something that you would need to be put on medication for. That's challenging because also there's not a guarantee, but I do think, like, I was just watching The Blue Zones on Netflix. Did you see it?
Yeah. Yes.
And I love it so much. And I read the book years ago, but I think it's to watch it and just to see the lifestyle factors and the commonalities of the de-stressing and the eating the whole foods. And it's not about carbs or protein or this or that. It's really just about like real food ingredients. And I mean, there's so many great messages like throughout the entire, you know, show, but I think the United States in particular, just to be honest, like when I think about it, like it upsets me, like how far away we are from like the European lifestyle of eating, or not even just Europe, because there's one of the Blue Zones, which is in Japan, but just how far away we are from that. It's just like, no wonder why we are like having such high rates of obesity and of heart disease and of type 2 diabetes and all of these just autoimmune disorders that I imagine, to your point, like could be helped and supported or not turned into something worse if maybe our lifestyle was and our country was more supportive of that.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And when I was watching that too, I think it was really helpful for me also as a reminder for myself too, this back to like simplicity of things, right? You know, it's just sometimes just need to like press pause and just go back to like the community and making sure that what we're nourishing ourselves with is more of these whole food ingredients, making time to enjoy the outside, our environment, with individuals who bring us joy, and then get movement in, right? And all of these things, it's hard, you're right, because sometimes it's abstract, like, well, I don't feel bad, and I'm young now, so why don't I just enjoy life now? And I have so many interactions with individuals. Once disease sets in, they're like, man, if I could just go back and talk to myself 20 years ago or 25 years ago, what would I say? And so it's a challenging conversation to have. And I will say, I do find that people are more receptive to it nowadays, because I think it's clear that we do have a problem with cardiometabolic disease here in the United States and worldwide, and recognizing that and the costs associated with it. I do see a lot of the younger generation, which has surprised me, being more aware of these things and asking me really important questions about what can I do to prevent this from being my reality, because I see it run in my family. So yeah, it brings me a lot of hope too. And I've been thrilled to see that.
Oh, that's incredible to hear. I love that. And another thing you said too around sleep, I was just thinking that we value time here in the US, and I think a lot of these other places, like specifically in the blue zones where there's like decreased risk and there's the longest essentially like longevity and life expectancy, they value time as well, but it manifests for us in different ways. So the way that they look at time is like, oh, we have, you know, like let's slow down, let's not be so stressed, let's sleep, let's, you know, go walk, and after meals. And in the US, we look at it as like, we only have this limited time in a day, so let's try to pack everything in that we possibly can, and let's sleep less. Like you said, 7 to 9 hours. And I love that you said that, because I sleep between 8 and 9 hours every single night. It's like my non-negotiable. Once again, I'm not a mother. I don't have a kid. I want to say that, but because I understand that that's different and it will be different at a different time of my life, hopefully. But all to say that, like, I understand that, like, my body, and I see the difference in my blood sugars, it contributes to this like underlying insulin resistance that isn't so evident, like to the naked eye, like nobody would really be able to tell, but I can just feel it, that there's this like base level of increased stress when they're sleep debt. And I think we should all get more selfish if we can about like really saying, okay, it's 7 to 8, 9 hours. Like that really is what a lot of us do need to set our bodies up for success.
Absolutely. And you know, when we sleep, a lot of hormonal regulation occurs. And so for us, and I think also at a very baseline level, people understand how important sleep is. I do think people understand it. Yet, even in that understanding, it is the one thing that is so easy to sacrifice, and usually the one thing that people will sacrifice for the purpose of what you just were talking about, was for the purpose of being as productive as possible, right? And that in that striving to be as productive as possible, we do compromise our health a lot. And, you know, one thing I'll say, and how this could even contribute to hastening of thyroid disease, if that's, you know, if someone has Hashimoto's and they're headed in that direction, you know, when we sleep, that also is the time where it allows our cortisol levels to reach a nadir so low that it gets to near zero in the middle of the night. And then usually starting around 4 or 6 o'clock in the morning, cortisol levels start to rise. Many of my patients with type 1 diabetes are very familiar with this phenomena. We're at 8 o'clock in the morning is the highest concentration of cortisol, which is, you know, known as the dawn phenomena. If it affects your blood sugars at that time, and then cortisol levels start to decline throughout the day, because that's the natural circadian rhythm of cortisol secretion. Well, if you compromise your sleep and don't get a sufficient amount of sleep, cortisol levels will stay higher than they're supposed to. They won't reach that nadir, is my point, right? So they'll stay detectable, they'll stay high. Well, okay, so what? Well, the issue is cortisol is our stress hormone, right? And so if our body is in a state of constant stress, that's going to affect our thyroid function as well. And so all of those signals and triggers could certainly hasten, could be one of the factors that hasten thyroid disease. And so I talk to people a lot about making sure they give themselves enough sleep opportunity, right? Because even if we say, oh, I'm going to bed at 10 o'clock and I'm waking up at 7 o'clock in the morning, great, that's 9 hours. But are you actually falling asleep, fast asleep at 10 o'clock and waking up immediately at 7? No, it probably takes you some time to fall asleep. Maybe you're getting up in the middle of the night and so forth. So there might be an interruption, but at least you give yourself the opportunity to get the full 8 hours, 9 hours of sleep. Even if you fall short, you're still within that 7 to 9 hours, right? So making sure you give yourself enough sleep opportunity to really aim and strive for that sacred amount of sleep.
And I don't know if you're on the same page about this, but for me, I think for years, I thought that exercise was number one, and that should be the priority every single day. And what happened was I had so much stress on my body, and I had a lot of gut health issues for like a 2-3 year period from many rounds of antibiotics that I had, like through an IV drip for days. And I mean, my weight within like 3 months, when I tell you, like, nothing changed in my life. And I've never had put on that much weight that quickly. It was like 20, 30 pounds. It was crazy. And no doctor was like, they were like, oh, watch where you're eating, decrease your calories. And I'm like, but like, there's something else going on here. And what I understood it to be was like gut health. It was my gut health, my gut, and needed to be restored. And so what ended up happening was I just went down a rabbit hole of like kind of pulling all the research and everything that I came together and essentially like got through it to the other side on my own. And what I think brought my body back into balance, I don't even know, because I never saw a practitioner. But the number one thing that I did was I stopped doing workouts at 6 a.m. That was for my whole entire life, like what as an adult, like throughout my 20s, was like, you wake up at 6 a.m. and you're going to be most productive when you just get the workout out of the way. You start your day that way with like intense cardio strength training. And I really do think that like trading that for an extra hour and a half of sleep and also working out not with just coffee in my system, like just like all these little changes all centered around like decreasing stress, even more than I think food, really, really helped my body come back into a place of balance hormonally. And I know that there's not maybe as much research that supports more of that like functional medicine approach, but I mean, from my own approach and just like my own experience, that is what I found to be true. And so I'm really passionate too about just sharing that story and talking about things like sleep, because I think everybody thinks health is like exercise and nutrition, and that stress and that sleep piece is so, so important for so many reasons that you just stated.
Yes, absolutely. And nutrition and exercise are important. As you said, they're very important. And we need to make sure that sleep and stress mitigation and healthy social engagements get the same amount of timeshare as the other things too, because frequently those are the things that are being overlooked. And so, you know, if you're a patient that has gone to see physicians and you're like, I know I'm eating as healthy as I can, right? I've been putting in that effort. I know I'm exercising. Why do I still feel this way? That's part of the lifestyle medicine. There are all these other things too that are contributing to our health. And people are really shocked when they get that sleep or they put up the boundaries at work saying, no, I'm not going to tape up on more projects because I am maxed out right now. Or they start making time to catch up with their friends, you know, and grab a coffee with them or go meet up with them. That, oh, I feel better. And it didn't involve taking yet another medicine, right? These are things that once we talk about it, and it's a really powerful message because it's a message essentially of empowerment. You can, it's not easy, but you can make some of these changes and you have the availability to really feel better. And so these are really important conversations that providers should have with their patients. And not all providers are comfortable with having those conversations or have the knowledge as to why we should be having that more. But absolutely. And I'm thrilled to hear that that had been, you know, I'm sorry that everybody just kept on going back to like diet and exercise. But the fact that you were able to bring in these other things and find something that your body responded to, I think is just testament to the need to look at the whole picture, like really take a zoom out approach.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think it's hard to think something as simple. It's almost like you think the answer has to be more complex. It has to be like more taking out these foods or more exercise and more. And it's like sometimes the answer is less. Less is more. So going back to thyroid specifically, I have a few questions here that I want to ask you. These are questions that came from people within the Risley community who have, you know, type 1 diabetes, obviously, but also thyroid disorder. So first question, and some of these may be too specific. So you let me, you can say like, hey, this might be too specific and like you'd have to go to your provider, but let's start with this first one. This first one says, I was recently diagnosed with Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, and it's hard balancing what's really helpful info and also just someone's opinion. I would love to know what would be some really good material to start out with to improve health slash foods, working out. What should I do?
Great question. And I have this discussion a lot with people because one of the wonderful things about the internet is that we can get information like that. The challenging thing, however, is trying to sift through all this information and determine what's medical fact versus what's medical opinion. Okay. And so with resources, I will start by saying endocrinologists, our training is in hormones, right? And organs that produce hormones. And so I would hope that endocrinologists that you go to will have the time to share with you their expertise in explaining the medical condition and what to expect with the disease and therapies that are available, both pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic therapies. I will tell you that the American Thyroid Association, ATA, has great patient resources. So that's a great website to go to read about just all the different types of thyroid disease, and they have it in very accessible terms. Also, the Endocrine Society, they have their website and patient resources that talk about all types of endocrine disease, but included is thyroid disease. And the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, you know, you've heard Lauren and I discuss a lot about lifestyle medicine, and lifestyle medicine absolutely gets applied to all different type of medical conditions, including thyroid disease. And so they're a wonderful resource also to tap into in their website to learn more about like what is lifestyle medicine and how does that help reduce inflammation, reduce the propensity for this continued autoimmune attack on the body. So those are three helpful resources that I would direct people to.
Great. Thank you for sharing that. The next question is, are there lifestyle factors that I can change once I'm on medication to lessen the symptoms of having a thyroid disorder?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And what I would share is it really depends on the person. And I know that can be like so frustrating, but it's also so true. And I'll just give you the example from my own personal perspective of living with thyroid disease. So I am a board certified endocrinologist. And I was diagnosed with hypothyroidism in my late 20s. And it wasn't until I started following a more whole food approach to nutrition, you know, which I'm embarrassed to say, it hadn't occurred to me for a long majority of my endocrine professional life. And then I was finally like, okay, I'm hearing about this. Let me actually apply this. And I was like, oh, I feel so much better. Like energy levels through the roof. My hair just got so much thicker. It didn't start falling out as much. And this pesky, you know, like just uncomfortable way of feeling just went away. And that's also what inspired me to be like, why not having these conversations with my patients, the power of nutrition. And so the reason why I say that is because for me, it was more about whole food, plant-based eating. I really minimized the unhealthy fats and really focused on healthy fats and fiber as much as possible. And noticed that that had a profound impact for me. And I had always sort of resigned myself to being like, I'm just going to sort of feel this kind of way of meh, because I have Hashimoto's hypothyroidism. So that's just how it is. And then I realized, no, you don't have to always feel that way. There is still a lot that can be done from a lifestyle perspective that you can feel a whole lot better.
one of my favorite quotes, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it's that like, you don't know when you feel crummy for long enough, feeling crummy starts to feel normal. And I think that scales for any disease, right? Like type 1 diabetes. I mean, years, especially in my teenage years, I was like, thought I was just this moody person who was always just like tired. And like, yes, some of it was probably like teenage hormones, but even like into my like early 20s, a lot of it turned out to be, oh, hello. Like when you're high for hours, like even if it's over the nighttime that you wake up and rage, like still that impacts you. And you can feel so much better and so much lighter when you are working on your blood sugar. So I appreciate that answer. They won't get mad at me. I hope you guys won't get mad at me, but they'll want me to ask a follow-up question. When you say whole foods, I think that there is some people who will say like whole foods includes grass-fed meat. And then there are other people who will say whole foods is like more plant-based specifically and doesn't include meat or dairy. Like, can you define a little bit more about when you say whole foods?
Sure. Whole foods means eating a food that is as close to its natural form as possible without going through several rounds of just processing, and also really avoids a lot of added salt, oils, and sugars. So that whole food designation can include grass-fed beef. And then there's also whole food plant-based. And so I think you heard me say also whole food plant-based. And whole food plant-based doesn't necessarily mean vegan. It just means eating more plants and really focusing on eating more fiber-rich foods. A Mediterranean approach to eating is a whole food plant-based approach to eating. And there can be, you know, I also don't want to initiate any nutrition wars because there are a lot of different nutrition approaches. But I'm a big advocate for whole food nutrition, meaning as unprocessed as possible, right? And so, you know, when I make my oats in the morning, do I add my unsweetened plant-based milk? Yes. And then will people be like, well, that's processed? Yes, that is true, right? Again, my point is as unprocessed as possible. And so, you know, instead, what I offer is instead of having the apple juice, have the apple, right? Instead of having the sweetened applesauce, you can make your own applesauce from the apples. Instead of the fruit snack strawberries, just have the strawberry itself. So really just trying to eat as much of the true food as possible, and coming back to like the blue zones, people were growing their own food. Now, wouldn't that be wonderful if all of us could make our own garden and grow our own food? Yes. Is that the reality? No. Some people can, and I think that's amazing. But again, like when we go shopping, that's the perimeter of the grocery store that we're trying to grab from, right? And really trying to minimize what we're grabbing from the center, which tends to be more of the packaged or ultra processed foods, and really just trying to keep it as healthy and clean as possible.
Right. And another way you can say it is like kind of like 80-20, where in that 20%, you're going to have the almond milk, you're going to have maybe pretzels or whatever it is. But I still think in that 20%, if you have the accessibility to be able to choose between having a bag of, you know, Cheetos that have 17, 20 different ingredients in it and choosing a snack that still satisfies that same kind of craving, but it has, you know, 5 ingredients or 6 ingredients. Like it's just the better choice if you can do that. So no, thank you for sharing that. I think everybody would agree. It's kind of like, I don't know, it makes sense, right? Just eat as much as you can. Like that's unprocessed and you notice, you feel immediately better with that. So I guess another question, we have 2 more questions here. The question that is more specific, I don't know if you could answer, but it says, what does it mean to have a normal TSH and slightly high T4 free? I'm on levothyroxine.
Yes, great question. So, you know, with thyroid hormone levels, the way that the hormone system works is that there's an organ that produces a hormone. And that hormone can then attached to receptors on a different organ that then produces more hormones. So for example, since we're talking about the thyroid, the pituitary gland is a gland that is in our brain and just geographically located right above where our eye nerves, optic nerves, cross. And so it's this tiny gland, and it has an anterior portion to it and a posterior portion to it. And the anterior portion secretes six hormones. Even though it's so tiny, it secretes six different hormones. And one of those hormones is thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH. Guess what TSH does? It attaches to the thyroid and stimulates the thyroid to make hormone. And the thyroid therefore makes T4 and T3. Okay. So in order for hormones, which are proteins, to travel through the body, the majority of them have to be bound to other proteins in order to get to their receptors throughout the body. And we have thyroid receptors on our heart, thyroid receptors in our brain, thyroid receptors on different cells of our body throughout the body. And the thyroid makes human thyroids. The majority of the hormone it makes is T4 over T3. It makes both, but mostly T4 over T3. So when we do thyroid blood tests, it is true that the TSH is the most sensitive and still the one that bears the most weight in knowing if the pituitary is sensing whether or not there's enough T3 and T4 circulating. Because if there is not enough, it's the T4 that signals back to the pituitary and says, okay, we're in balance. And then the pituitary is like, great, I'm just going to keep making the TSH that I need to. But if there's not enough T4, then the pituitary is like, what's going on? And increases the TSH to stimulate, trying to really get that thyroid to make more T4 and T3. That's why in hypothyroidism, you'll see the TSH go up because the free T3 and free T4 tend to be down. Whereas the opposite is true in hyperthyroidism. Okay, so the question is, how can you see a normal TSH and higher free T4? Well, when someone's taking levothyroxine, that is T4. Okay, and so it could be that just from taking it, your free T4, which is the hormone that's not bound to protein, when you check it, you can see, okay, it's mildly higher than what the reference range on the lab is. And I always encourage people to make sure if you're monitoring thyroid levels to try to get your levels checked at the same lab as much as possible, because each lab can have slightly different reference ranges. Okay, so that's number one. It can get confusing. The TSH lab assay has been around the longest and it is the most reliable one. The other thing I'll just mention too is that certain supplements can affect the TSH and free T4 level. And the one I really want to bring the most attention to is biotin. Because a lot of times, right, when people are having thyroid symptoms, such as hair loss or brittle nails, we know that biotin has been one of those supplements that has been promoted to help with hair strength and nail growth. In high doses of biotin, that interferes with the blood test, the lab assay for thyroid, as well as other hormones, but specific, we're talking about thyroid, where it can bring the TSH level down and the free T4 level up. And so I will always ask my patients, number one, are you on biotin? Two, are you on a hair and nail supplement? Three, are you on a multivitamin? So those are three different things that potentially could contain biotin. And if the answer is yes to any of those, sure, I can ask them, well, what's the dose you're on? I just have them hold it. Hold it for 5 days before you get your thyroid levels drawn to make sure that it's not interfering with the lab assay, so that when we get your levels, we know we're actually interpreting your body's true TSH and free T4 levels. So biotin is something that's really important for people to know about.
Oh, that's such a helpful tip about the supplements, because I feel like there's so many just supplements that you get and just you're like, oh, I'll take this. It says it's good for this. But really, like, especially if you're on other medications, like, to be careful. Okay, last question for you is somebody who said, where is it? I've always treated type 1 diabetes and my thyroid disorder separately. Do they have any connection as it impacts blood sugar specifically?
Ooh, that's a great question. So yes, sure. I mean, I would say as long as the thyroid levels are in at goal, then it should have minimal impact on blood sugars. I guess the way I'm understanding the question is, can thyroid disease impact blood sugar control. And so if someone is in a state of hypothyroidism, underactive thyroid, right, then everything tends to slow down. Metabolism slows down, and that in profound states can impact the metabolism of insulin. And so insulin could stay around longer, which could predispose someone to more hypoglycemia. And then the reverse is true. If someone is in a hyperthyroid state, or even in the treatment of hypothyroidism, if you're on too high a dose of thyroid medicine, you will force yourself into an unnatural overactive state, which is a catabolic state. It breaks stuff down and can raise blood sugars. And so that's something that I think is important for people to know. If they have both hypothyroidism or a thyroid disease of some sort and type 1 diabetes, and their blood sugar patterns just aren't making sense, and they're like, I've been doing all the things, you know, I've been, you know, mindful of my bolus, I've been pre-bolusing, I've been like sticking to eating the same thing every day, my sleep schedule is checked, my all this is check, 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 what's going on? Check your thyroid levels. And let's make sure that those are also in the normal range, because it is possible that the variability that you're seeing could be due to abnormal thyroid levels.
Oh, I learned so much in this episode with you. Thank you for spending this hour just sharing your knowledge, your personal experience, your professional experience with us. I imagine that if there is somebody out there who has type 1 diabetes and just got or has been living with a thyroid diagnosis, that this is going to be gold to listen to, because I was trying to even find things before this episode, and the articles that are written up about type 1 and thyroid, they get so, they're so scarce, or they're really not, it's, they're so general. So this was so wonderful, and I can't thank you enough.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always a thrill to speak with you, Lauren. And I love the questions that came, and also happy to, if people have ongoing questions, again, the resources I stated earlier are a wealth of information. So thank you. Thank you again for having me.
Of course. Dr. Sobel, leave us with, where can people connect with you? Where can they find you? I know your clinic is in Pittsburgh specifically, but plug yourself.
Oh, thank you. So I'm the owner of Summon Health, which is a cardiometabolic clinic, including type 1 diabetes, here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I do have medical licenses in New York, Maryland, West Virginia, Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana, and Florida. So I can see patients in those states as well. My website, always feel free to visit, is summonhealth.com. And you can find me on social media, both TikTok and Instagram, at Dr. Sandra I. Sobel.
Incredible. Thank you so much, Dr. Sobel. Appreciate you. And we'll see you next time. We are so grateful for the time we spent together today on this episode of Reclaim Your Rise. If this conversation resonated with you, or you just love the connection with other people living with T1D, it would mean a lot if you could please take a moment to leave a rating and review. Your feedback helps put this podcast in front of people who may not even know that resources and community like this exist. We look forward to being together next Tuesday, so make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss a single episode. And if through listening to the podcast, you're realizing that you need more support than what you're currently getting, apply for coaching at RiseleyHealth.com and talk to our team so you can stop struggling alone. Remember, diabetes isn't a challenge we chose, but it is one that we can rise above.